This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
Mintmobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
And welcome to We Are History. I'm Angela Barnes.
And I'm John O'Farrell.
You are indeed.
Angela has chosen today's topic, and it's a little bit different because it's not about one historical event, is it, Angela? It's more of a sort of fashionable phenomenon of the 16th and 17th century, maybe 18th century a bit as well.
A little bit of the 18th century. No, actually no. I've got that completely wrong. It's the 17th and 18th century.
Oh, look at your notes.
Look at me. It's 1600s and 1700s. I always find that hard to remember that the 1600s are the 17th century.
Yes, we're not professional historians, as you may have gathered.
Or mathematicians, as it turns out. No. But anyway, the point is, I've wandered out of the 20th century for this one, John.
Great.
Which is quite unusual for me, I know. Because I have chosen this week to talk about the Grand Tour.
Jeremy Clarkson's car program.
No, John.
I know you like fast cars, Angela.
I do like fast cars, John, but I don't like that I like fast cars, if you know what I mean. I don't like Jeremy Clarkson. It's complicated.
Anyway,
not that Grand Tour. We're talking today about the Grand Tour, which was basically a sort of gap year for rich boys in the 17th and 18th century.
Okay.
Did you go on a gap year, John? Not in the 17th or 18th century.
No, I'm not that old. Thank you. I know I'm a bit older than you.
Did you have a gap year?
Did no, I never did. No, they didn't either. It didn't occur to me when I was 18. I think I went off to university as the youngest child. As I went out the gate, Mum put the for sale sign up on the house and there was no bedroom for me to come back to. So that's how keen they were to see the back of me.
My mum moved to Ireland while I was at university, so that was quite a don't come home.
It's a message,
wasn't it?
Isn't it? And then my kids as well went straight off to university. I don't know. I think by the time they were 18, it was slightly tainted as a concept.
Yeah. Because it did change, didn't it, from being when I was a student in the mid-90s.
Yes.
When I was at school, it wasn't something that kids from Maidstone seemed to do, from
right.
where I was from,
no, me too.
Seemed to do. But when I went to a University of Sussex, and it's full of a lot of quite posh people go there. And suddenly I had these friends that I was living with at university, and they'd all met each other in Thailand that summer. And they were like, oh, no, hi, we met in...
Absolutely. Exactly the same experience. Yeah, I had people going, yeah, I was in China, and though the people there had no money, they shared it with us. And the other one, I was in a kibbutz, and we got up at 6 a.m. to pick grapefruits. And I was like, well, I was in the Hand and Flowers playing Space Invaders.
I did have a gap year, but I spent it working in a police station to earn money to go to university.
Right.
So that's the difference, I suppose. But I don't think I'd realised until I started that uni particularly how much smaller the world is when you're rich. I'd never even had a holiday abroad with my parents.
Yes. I mean, the one thing I'll say is that I didn't have a gap year, but then I was very well travelled as a young man.
Yeah.
So my parents, I came from a very comfortable background, but also we travelled a lot. So at the age of 3, I spent 6 months in America. When I was 13, we went to India.
Wow.
I'd been behind the Iron Curtain. I'd been to pretty well every country in Europe. So I was actually a bit bored of travel. Sounds shocking, but I was actually like, oh, God, I don't want to.
Whereas I've been to various pontins. Across
we're different.
The British Isles.
Yes, yeah.
Not even across the British Isles, in the south of the British Isles.
Yes. Yeah. So, I hadn't done a gap year, but I did have that same experience at university of people going, oh, God, it was so amazing at Machu Picchu. I really found myself there.
Yeah,
and I was like, well, I went to the park in Maidenhead. So the Grand Tour.
The Grand Tour, yeah.
Well, if you read, like we do, a lot about history, or if you watch those sort of E.M. Foster films or whatever, you often hear people talk about, after completing the Grand Tour or something about these sort of great Georgian gentlemen,
See, I'd heard the phrase a lot, but I didn't really know much about it. So I thought I'd learn some more about what they are.
And hopefully you have done. Otherwise, this will be a very short episode if you haven't done.
Yeah, absolutely. I did read a book for it, John. I read a book called The British Abroad, The Grand Tour in the 18th Century. And it's by Jeremy Black. And I read loads of other articles and bits and bobs as well. Because that book, it's not sort of a popular history, but it's quite a dense academic, loads of accounts and quotations. Jeremy Black's an archivist, so it's quite an academic tome.
Okay.
Not everyone's cup of tea. But if you've got access to JSTOR or anything like that, there's loads of interesting articles if you do want to read more.
Yeah.
And maybe we'll link some more in the show notes.
Yeah,
anyway.
I've said The British Abroad would be a very different title if it didn't have that subtitle.
The subtitle,
Grand Tour
yes,
in
it definitely
the 18th
needs
century.
So
tell us what the Grand Tour is all about then, Angela.
So from the mid-17th century, I've got that straight in my head now, so the 1600s, it became a sort of rite of passage for the male heir of noble, aristocratic, rich families to go on a bit of a jolly, which they called the Grand Tour.
Okay.
They would have been to university, completed their formal education, so it was a sort of finishing school for upper-class idiots. Sort of polish them up, expand their horizons before they'd come back, get married, take up their titles and households and whatever their future held.
Where does the expression come from? Why the Grand Tour?
So it comes from, there was a 17th century travel writer. He was a Roman Catholic priest called Richard Lascelles. I think it's Lascelles, isn't it? And he wrote a guidebook called The Voyage of Italy, which was published in 1670. And that's the first time the Grand Tour was used in this way.
So the concept of tourism, as we know, didn't really exist until the railways came along. Before the 17th century, the main reason that people travelled anywhere were for work, survival, or religious pilgrimage. Not really for a jolly or for your education, I suppose.
No, that's something, it really sort of came hand in hand with the Enlightenment, this period of discovery and learning that flourished among Europeans and Americans from about 1680 to 1820.
Yeah, and lots of famous people did it, didn't they? There would be, Boswell writes about Samuel Johnson's, and Byron, Wordsworth, John Ruskin, Samuel Taylor Coleridge. They all did the Grand Tour.
Pretty much any noble gentleman of that time would have done a version of the Grand Tour. And the tour, it could last anything from just a few months to several years.
Wow.
Yeah. Some were like 8 years away. And they'd usually take in a chunk of Europe. For the more intrepid tourists, they might head as far as the Ottoman Empire, maybe even to Russia.
Okay.
You have to be quite intrepid to do those ones, I think. Quite a lot of Grand Tours took in parts of the Holy Roman Empire. So that's what's now Germany, bits of Poland, Austria, over that way. They were quite popular because there were lots of royal courts in those areas. You know, you had your Hanoverians and all of you. And so these elite young men would have connections in those places to stay, introductions, you know.
Right.
But those areas also had a reputation for really terrible roads, so not everyone went there.
Okay. So we're going to concentrate, Angela, on the most common route for a Grand Tour, is that right? Because the place a young man in his formative years simply had to go was Rome.
Yes, the cradle of the classics, which of course was so important to the making of an 18th century man and a 21st century Conservative MP.
Exactly.
They're all obsessed.
Who could you be? There's a line in my recent book about politics about me and Boris Johnson. I said, we could both quote Homer, just not the same one.
Yeah, exactly. I've got a line actually about this as well. I've got a line about how, you know, just being able to speak Latin doesn't make you a good leader. Tell you who else can speak Latin, Catholic priests, and I wouldn't let for them babysit. But anyway.
Very good. Classics does seem to be a sort of prerequisite for this upper class idea of sort of masculinity and civilization.
It's really tied in with it, isn't it? Samuel Johnson, he wrote in 1776, a man who has not been in Italy is always conscious of an inferiority from his not having seen what it is expected a man should see.
That sounds a bit dodgy to me.
Does a bit.
Maybe we should say at this point it wasn't just young British men that did the Grand Tour during this era. Mm. There were some women who did it, and other nationalities had their version of the same thing.
Yeah, there were women who did Grand Tours. They were much rarer, obviously, and it definitely wasn't a routine part of an upper-class young woman's education to go on a Grand Tour. It would usually be either spinsters, or sometimes it might be a woman accompanying a diplomat husband, or maybe women would flee to Europe as a means of escape quite often, I think. think, from some sort of shame or humiliation at home, or to distance themselves from a husband who'd been abusive or even just was plain boring.
What is your reason for travel? My husband's really boring.
Yeah.
Yeah. Of course, women couldn't initiate divorces in those days, so it could be the only way to leave a husband, disappear over the Alps for a bit.
Yeah, exactly. This is quite famous women. Mary Wollstonecraft, author of Vindication of the Rights of Women and Mary Shelley's mum.
Yep.
She travelled through Scandinavia in the late 18th century, which is quite a thing when you think about it. Catherine the Great embarked on a grand tour in the 1760s before taking the throne as Empress of Russia. There were lots of travelogues written by the women who did do it, but there weren't as many of them.
And grand tours for men weren't always done purely for educational reasons either, were they? It could be a great cover for someone who had to get away for a bit, you know, like the women you're talking about. Maybe to let the dust settle after they'd done something unseemly.
Yeah.
Could be a divorce or bankruptcy or knocking up the parlourmaid.
Yeah, it's a good way to just sort of disappear for a while. But for the young British heir, it was pretty much an essential rite of passage to go and do your grand tour, usually across continental Europe. There was a word for these young nobles making their tour. They were known as milords.
Okay.
Spelled M-I-L-O-R-D, or on the continent they'd be known as milordy.
And I imagine these hordes of young British men travelled respectfully and without complaining across the continent, making an effort to assimilate and learn. Would I be right there, Angela?
Well, you might be surprised, John, to hear. British were quite xenophobic towards their European neighbours.
I know,
it's hard to imagine. To them at that time, the French were warmongers, the Italians were villains. They had pretty set stereotypes of their European friends.
Wow.
And I don't know how much evidence there is that the Grand Tours did much to challenge that, really. There was apparently a famous satirical drawing at the time of a woman who went to France, and she was amazed at how well the French spoke French.
That's funny. I remember being on the beach in Brittany and finding a postcard written in English, and the postcard said, "Lots of French here."
Amazing.
Yeah. So you're a young man about to embark on your grand tour. What do you need, Angela? What, a passport, some euros, wheelie case full of condoms?
Pretty much. Not the passports, though. You didn't need a passport to travel to France. Passports had existed in various forms since the 15th century, but people didn't really bother with them. Because you think it's a faff getting a passport now, right? Until 1794, each passport issued had to be signed by the monarch.
Right. Yeah. But they didn't travel particularly light, did they? The grand tourists, I imagine. Because you did your travel trunk, letters of introduction to influential people in the places to be visited. Yeah. And you got maps, books. No internet, Angela. No internet back then.
No internet.
See, we know about our history.
Yeah.
Scientific instruments, if you were planning on doing a bit of science, research, drawing things maybe, painting supplies. And then journals. You've got to have your writing implements. Fully stocked medical box, because you can't trust those continental doctors.
No.
Small weapon, maybe a pistol, perhaps for protection, or in case you find yourself having to duel.
Yeah, you know. Don't you hate it when that happens on holiday?
God,
I've got in a duel again.
He spilled my pint. We're getting swords at dawn.
You might take some foreign currency. There were a lot of British bankers who sort of set themselves up in places on the continent where the tourists came.
Wow.
And as well as helping arrange your finances, or they could get you letters of credit if you ran out of money and things like that, they could also help you arrange your accommodation and make introductions to people locally and stuff. So
it's a whole industry.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And if you did run low on cash, you could always arrange a loan from the local consulate or old family friends, expats in towns you're visiting.
Yeah, you know how it is with these rich folk. There's always just money, right? There's always someone they can get money from, even when they haven't got any. And of course, you wouldn't be travelling alone, John.
Yeah.
You'd take with you a sort of tutor. He's the most important person, a man older than you, who's knowledgeable about the places you're going. He's going to be your guide.
Wow.
He's going to teach you as you go. They were known as, I guess it's Ciceronis? I'm not sure how you pronounce that. Or sometimes they were called bear leaders.
Wow.
And they also acted as a sort of chaperone and a companion, I suppose.
Right.
But of course, you're going to take a few servants with you too, John.
I always find that makes things easier.
You can't not take your servants on holiday. And depending just how wealthy you are, you might also even take your own carriage. If not, there were stagecoaches and post carriages and things you could hitch lifts on, and sort of early form of public transport.
For the cross-channel ferry.
Exactly. Well, we'll come on to that. There were staging posts. You know, so you'd take your carriage and then swap horses as you went along.
Amazing. So the only thing you probably didn't bother packing was your toothbrush.
Yeah.
Because they didn't really start using those till the 1800s,
did they?
That's
right, yeah. So you're packed, time to head for a port, I guess. You've got to get over to mainland Europe.
Right.
So you might head to Southampton, Brighton, Harwich, but more often than not to Dover, Shorty's Crossing, to cross to Calais or Boulogne. Now, if you're taking your own carriage, what you've got to do is disassemble it at the port.
Wow.
So you've ridden from where... Because they came from all over the country, of course. They weren't just coming from London and the southeast. So it could take you days, weeks to get to the port.
Wow.
You disassemble your carriage and then you just reassemble it on the other side when you get there.
Yes.
Easy.
You say easy, but probably easier when you had servants doing that for
you.
Well,
yes, quite.
Talking about, you know, gap years, my privileged background. When I was 13, as I say, we're in India, we went hiking up in the Himalayas and camping, but we had Sherpas looking after us and they cooked our food and led us up the mountains and pitched the tents and, you know, gave us the eggs that they had from the chickens tied to the back of the horses. And then on the last day, they served us chicken. So,
brilliant, yes.
Very, but
didn't
I mean,
have to carry them back.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't think you can do that in Kashmir anymore. It's too much of a war zone. But back then, that was an incredible experience for a 13-year-old. So yes, that's modern day equivalent, I suppose, of having servants on holiday.
Yeah.
So what? P&O though. Hop on the P&O, get to Calais.
About an hour? No, not exactly, John. The crossings were pretty ad hoc, so you might be able to get seats on the post packet, which was like a mail boat that would cross the channel, or you could buy a passage on a private boat.
Right.
And remember, boats then aren't like they are now. They weren't quite as windproof. They were smaller. So if it was too windy, you couldn't sail. If it wasn't windy enough, you couldn't sail.
Of course.
So you could be stuck somewhere like Dover for weeks just waiting for a crossing.
But so much to do in Dover. No offence, person from Kent.
So when you did get on a boat, it could take 3 days before you finally reach the other side. And then you're going to have to transfer to a small fishing or rowing boat to land. Extortion was a problem.
Yes. Yes, I imagine the French sailors could basically charge what they liked to help you land. Because once you got that far, you're not going to pay anything to get off that bloody boat, aren't you, onto dry land.
Yeah. And even then, you might end up landed many miles from where you intended to be.
So you've landed, you've got the indignity of having all your belongings rifled through by French customs. And then after all that, you probably want to get your head down and have a stiff drink.
Yeah. I mean, luckily, places like Calais and Boulogne, they're really used to catering for these grand tourists. So there are loads of inns where you can get some rest, get something to eat and drink before usually setting straight off for Paris. The roads on the continent, of course, weren't as good as those back home.
Of course they weren't. British roads. Britain's roads were pretty good by this point because of the Turnpike Acts, raising revenue for their maintenance.
Yeah, that's right. And continental roads were rough and full of potholes.
How the situation is reversed today.
Yeah, quite. But that meant the carriage is often overturned, which could delay your trip while you're waiting for repairs.
So once on the road, on average, the tourists could cover about 15, 20 miles a day.
Yeah.
And if the roads were particularly difficult, parts of the trip would be undertaken by foot.
That's right.
Yeah.
So most of the grand tourists, they head straight from Calais to Paris. They might pop in to visit a cloth factory or nunnery or something on the way, but they wanted to get to where the good stuff was. And before we get to Paris, John, I think that's a good place to stop for a break, reassemble this carriage you came in on today, and we'll come back after this.
Fantastic.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
So we're back. We're talking about the Grand Tour of the 17th and 18th centuries. They just got to Paris to see the Eiffel Tower and they went, oh, where is it? It's not been built yet, so I'm totally sorry about that.
Oh, dear John. So we've just got to Paris. What's the first thing you're going to do?
I suppose Notre Dame Cathedral, maybe. Bit of delicious French cuisine. Drink some vin rouge, maybe.
First things first, you're going to buy yourself an entire new wardrobe, John.
Wow. Of course. I don't want to go wandering around Europe in the wrong gear.
No, that would be terrible. You know what it's like when you go on holiday, John? You want to fit it. I bet you've succumbed to a sarong on the beach in your time.
Yeah, a little henna tattoo.
Yeah,
you know
I
me.
Bet you have.
Corn beads in my hair.
Oh, God. Now we've gone on to cultural appropriation. So you're in Paris, you're going to spend a good few weeks in Paris, by the way. So while you're there, you're going to get yourself some dancing and fencing lessons.
Right, because you don't want to dip yourself with all the fancy continental dancing and fencing you're going to be doing,
exactly,
do you?
Exactly. So you'd have those lessons. You'd spend several hours a day with your bear leader.
Oh, yeah.
Brushing up on your French. French at the time is the language of diplomacy, so you're going to be needing it across Europe quite a lot. They didn't have Duolingo then, John, so you'd have some French lessons every day.
You mean they're not just going to be shouting at Johnny Foreign? Uno Biro, mate. Uno Biro.
Well, in reality, yeah, probably. That's if they bother speaking to Johnny Foreigner at all.
Right.
It's fair to say that the British tourists often sought out the company of other British tourists or expats on their grand tours.
Brits abroad sticking together and not integrating with the locals. It could never happen today,
Angela. It could never happen today, John. We should have a "It would never happen today" alarm or bell, like the QI klaxon.
Yes, indeed.
That sort of... Anyway, they tended to travel in groups, these milords abroad. That's quite a good phrase, that. The milords abroad, we should call them that. There was a grand tourist, William Fitzgerald, who was the Marquess of Kildare, and he wrote home in 1768 from Turin. I'll let you read this, John, because you give good posh bloke.
How dare you. We are about 10 English at present, and 8 of us were at Eton together. It's amazing how one picks up our old Eton acquaintances abroad. I dare say I've met above 40 since I've been in Italy.
Yeah, so it's basically the backpacker trail of its day, except some other poor sods carrying your backpack.
So, you're in Paris with your new threads. You can dance, you can fence, you can say, je voudrais un croissant, s'il vous plaît.
Yep, so you're ready to go. You might visit a few churches, maybe go to the Notre Dame, Val de Grâce, a few palaces, promenade in the Tuileries, pop down to the Palace of Versailles to watch the king have his dinner, which for some reason that seemed to be a popular thing for them to do, just go and watch the king have his dinner.
And if you have the right connections, you might even meet a few celebrities of the day.
Yeah, apparently it's quite popular to nip over to Strasbourg and have lunch with Voltaire.
Okay.
Yeah, a lot of the tourists did that.
Wow, my dream dinner party. But for the majority, Angela, they wanted to crack on with the really good stuff.
Yeah.
And that meant heading to Italy, didn't it?
It did. So there were two ways you could do that from Paris. You could head down to Marseille, and from there you could hire an Italian boat, these little boats called feculars.
Careful how you say that.
And they would be very careful. And they would take you, it sounds sort of somehow gynecological.
We're just going to check your fecula, madam.
You know, or we're just going to use the fecula.
To check your fecula. Stop saying fecula, everyone.
So they would take you across in their fecula, but it had problems, John.
Right.
Firstly, you had the issue of waiting for the right wind again, and so you could be there for weeks waiting. They were Genoese sailors that ran the boats, and they had a bit of a reputation at the time.
Oh, I bet they did.
Not that sort of reputation, John. They had a reputation for being lazy.
Right.
The envoy in Turin, John Molesworth, he wrote, time for your posh bloke again, John.
No mariners in the world are as cowardly as the Italians in general, but especially the Genoese, so that upon the least appearance of a rough sea, they run into the first creek where their feculars are sometimes windbound for a month.
That sounds like a terrible medical situation.
I've got a windbound fecula.
And then, John, when you did get going, when you had the right wind, you get on the boat, the lazy Italians have bothered to get out of bed, then you've got the problem of Barbary pirates in the water.
God, I don't fancy that much. What's the other option?
Well, your other option is to take your carriage, or if you didn't bring one, you'd hop on the Lyon Diligence, which is sort of public transport stagecoach to Lyon.
Okay.
And from there, you can nip straight across the Italian border as soon as you've got over the small hurdle that is the Alps.
Oh, yeah. There weren't many roads over that, were there? In fact, there was no road that could take a carriage over the Alps until the 19th century. So how did they get across it?
What they'd do, John, is they'd pack down their carriage again.
Oh, God.
And that and all this stuff you brought with you would be carried over the mountains by mules on a sort of mule train.
Okay.
And you would be carried to the summit on a sort of sedan chair carried by local guides.
Wow.
There was a Richard Pocock who made the crossing in 1734. He wrote about it and he said he was, John?
Oh, delighted by the speed of the crossing.
And he observed...
Nothing at all.
I thought, yeah, not for you, mate. What about the poor sods carrying you?
How come I keep being cast as the posh man in this?
Have you just noticed that I've done that to you all the way through?
I'm quite enjoying it, to be honest. Imagining myself being carried in a sedan chair.
It's not much of a stretch, to be fair. Yeah. I'd say it's less of a stretch for you than it would be for me. But yeah, they were carried in this sedan chair over the... Yeah. How dare he write, oh, it's hardly anything. It's like, of course it wasn't. You just had to sit. But anyway, once you'd reached the summit, they then get this sort of big sledge thing that everyone would get on and you'd slide down into the plains of Piedmont. And this interesting, you know, last summer I filmed a TV show, which may or may not have been on when this goes out because it's on imminently. It's called World's Most Dangerous Roads.
Fantastic, and I can't wait to see it.
Let me tell you, they're not fraught with danger today, the crossing the Alps from France to Italy. Because this is where we started the other side. So we came over through Piedmont, then over to France. But I was in a Land Rover Defender, so a bit different to a stagecoach and a sedan chair. But I had Rod Gilbert driving, which I would say was more terrifying in many ways.
I'm sure you're very calm and very...
I definitely didn't swear like a docker the whole time.
When you're stressed, the swear words come out.
I don't want to give away too much because you have to watch the programme when it's on. I mean, we had a great time. It was me and Rod Gilbert. We both drove and we were on these tiny little... They were old military roads. They're actually 19th century military roads and they were unpaved.
Wow.
So it was like off-roading, but on the side of a mountain. It was pretty bloody scary.
Oh, God. So you're in Piedmont. You're heading for Turin.
And at the time, Turin, it was the home to the royal court of the Kingdom of Sardinia.
Okay.
And that was a very pro-British place. So a lot of them started there because they could have the royal court, they'd have contacts, and that could be a focus for their activities. Then they'd have a bit of a party there. And from Turin, they might head to Milan, maybe, particularly after La Scala opened in 1778. So they'd pop across to Milan, watch an opera.
Right. See a couple of football matches, AC Milan, Internazionale, that sort of thing. Yeah.
That.
Most crucially, most grand tourists were looking to hit the big four, weren't they? That's Venice, Florence, Rome and Naples.
That's right, because by this time, Venice was past its sort of heyday as a trading power, but the British viewed it as this quintessential Renaissance city, so it was a must-see. You had to go to Venice.
Yeah, so famous for its carnival, of course, which would last for weeks from Boxing Day to Shrove Tuesday. Venice was a non-stop whirl of parties and masquerades, visits to the opera, firework displays.
Yeah, and courtesans.
Oh, here we go.
Yeah, Venetian courtesans had a bit of a reputation. It's no wonder these lads were desperate to get there, really, because the Venetian courtesans were well known, shall we say, for being, quote, brazen and beautiful.
Okay.
Grand tourist Thomas Coryat wrote, here you go, John, it's posh bloke again.
Oh, here we go. 2,000 courtesans in the city, whereof many are esteemed so loose that they are said to open their quiver to every arrow.
Just what the doctor ordered after weeks of French and fencing lessons.
Nice image, Tom.
Isn't it? Lovely.
Yeah, lovely.
So after all that partying in Venice, you might head down to Florence, chill out for a bit, place to relax and unwind, visit the Uffizi Gallery and other art galleries, churches and palaces to see the paintings and sculptures.
It's all about the art in Florence, isn't it? Here they'd see paintings that they could never have seen before and styles they would never have come across in Britain. Remember that, you know, books with colour plates were not a thing.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so they're seeing these paintings for the first time.
Yeah.
And then, John... onto the big one.
Ah, Rome.
Rome.
Yes.
Yes, where like all red-blooded men, they'd get a real hard-on for all that old Roman stuff.
Yes. So the tourists might engage the services of an antiquarian to show them around and tick off all the big sites.
Yeah.
Colosseum, Pantheon, St. Peter's, Basilica, Roman Forum, Sistine Chapel,
Pizza Place.
Yeah.
Lot to entertain the grand tourists in Rome. Well, all over Italy, really. You could go and get your portrait done by leading artists of the day. There was a guy called Pompeo Battoni, and he specialised in painting these Milordi on their tour. In fact, I read something about he had like 275 paintings, and 200 of them were of British tourists.
God.
And you could even commission a portrait with some ruins in the background to prove you've been there. It's before holiday snaps.
So it's a selfie.
So yeah,
it's,
yeah.
It's a selfie in front of the...
with the ruins in the background.
That's hilarious.
Brilliant.
So for these guys, it wasn't just a fridge magnet and a straw donkey. They lost their minds when it came to mementos for their trip.
Oh yeah, souvenirs were a really important part of the Grand Tour. In fact, it sparked a whole new industry. And they'd take original artifacts, they'd take fakes, they'd take fans decorated with pictures of the Colosseum, coins, medals, snuff boxes, decorated glass, paintings of themselves holding up the Tower of Pisa, you name it, they collected it.
And if the locals couldn't provide you with original artifacts for your budget, quite a substantial market in manufactured fakes.
Oh yeah, locals were like, yeah, sure, we can get you a genuine Roman coin. Of course we can.
Yes.
And remember, loads of these grand tourists, they're going home to these huge country estates, these huge country piles.
Yeah.
And they want to make their own marks on them when they take them over as the heir. So they'd furnish them in styles influenced by their travels, and they'd fill them with stuff they sent back. Loads of stately homes, even today, they have sculpture galleries, and they were often specially built just to accommodate the Roman statues and marble work they brought back from the Grand Tour.
Yeah. So we know people like the architect John Soane, who are now famous for having these vast collections of stuff they've nabbed from around the world. And often those collections started on a Grand Tour, didn't
they? Yeah, exactly. So then once you've rinsed Rome of knickknacks or valuable artefacts that they probably actually wanted to keep in Rome, Naples was then often the final stop on your Grand Tour, because from there it was quite easy to get a boat to take you back home. And Naples became known as a little bit of a party town, John, and that was largely due to Sir William Hamilton. Now, he served as a British envoy to the court of Naples from 1764 until 1800.
Right.
And he was known for putting on these lavish do's and musical evenings with his wife, a certain Lady Emma Hamilton.
Ah, the one who ended up having a fling with old Nelson.
Yeah, the very same. And at these parties, she would do this party piece, right? And she called them attitudes.
Okay.
And what she would dress up in robes, and she sort of portrayed these classical sculptures in a kind of tableau or paintings of Greco-Roman mythical figures. So she'd just stay there in this tableau, and all the guests, all the audience, they would have to guess who she was being.
Well,
that was her party
God,
piece.
You made your own entertainment in those days, didn't you?
you really did.
You just managed to make a parlor game sound even more boring than charades.
I know, but it was still more fun than Pictionary, though.
Naples wasn't just about the parties, though, was it? From there, you could do a trip to observe the excavations at Pompeii.
Yeah.
Or pop over to Herculaneum. I've got to tell you about my mum. When she was in Greece, she said, I rang her up when she was in Greece. I said, how are you getting on? She goes, oh, terrible time. We took an 11-hour boat trip to go to Rhodes because I wanted to see the Colossus. And when I got there, it wasn't there anymore. I said, Mum, it was destroyed in about 200 BC. She was, well, I know that now, but I wouldn't have booked if I'd known that. So these guys were probably, you know, hoping to see sort of old Roman and Greco-Roman ruins.
Well, Pompeii and Herculaneum were new excavations. It was really exciting and really...
cutting edge.
You know, and they would sometimes finance excavations, and they would pay the archaeologists bribes to remove artifacts, have them shipped home for their ever-growing collections. So they would really, if they had the money to go on, dig a bit more and get me some stuff.
Yes,
they would. I think we should take a little break there, John. We've come to the end of the Grand Tour.
Oh, okay.
I'll tell you what, while we take a break, I'll pose as a figure from Greek mythology and you can guess who I am.
That's easy.
Yeah, we'll see you in a bit.
Hello and welcome back to We Are History Part 3.
Yes, we're back. And in case you were wondering, John sadly didn't correctly guess which attitude I was portraying during the ad break. It was Orthrus the two-headed dog.
Yeah.
Well, you were close because you guessed Cerberus the three-headed dog, but it was just that Tina the cockapoo had jumped on my lap.
I always do that. That's a classic mistake. So we're talking about the Grand Tour of the 17th and 18th centuries, which for the wealthiest young men was a rich mix of cultural education and, let's be honest, Angela, sexual enlightenment.
Yes, because the tours weren't set in stone. You could tailor your itinerary and your experience to what most interested you.
Yes, so there were plenty who didn't bother too much with the culture and education element of the Grand Tour and concentrated more on the shagging and drinking their way across the continent for years aspect.
Yes, nothing's really changed, has it? You've got your culture vultures, you've got your club 1830s, it's horses for courses.
Absolutely. So if you think about it, these boys really, in their late teens, early 20s, who'd been educated at all male schools and at all male universities, suddenly They were let loose. They were in cities, away from home, going to dances, the opera, theatres. They had access to actresses, dancers, courtesans, bored, rich housewives.
Yeah. Actually, in Italy, there was something called, now, again, I'm not sure how to pronounce it, Cecibiship, something like that.
Right.
But it was this idea that it was perfectly acceptable for a married Italian woman to take a male companion to social gatherings who wasn't her husband and would often also be her lover. And wow, that was just sort of a done thing.
Okay.
And the British grand tourists would often fulfil this role. They're like, wow, yeah, I'll do that.
God, okay. These randy young men.
Yeah.
So some grand tourists fell in love with the women they met. Mm-hmm. This was first time in it.
Holiday romances.
I love it. No, you're just...
We've all had one.
It seems Byron repeatedly fell in love with women he met on his grand tour, particularly in Greece.
Yeah, you say women. It was a bit dodgier than that. There was one of them was Therese Macri. She was a 12-year-old girl that he tried to buy from her landlady mother.
Okay.
He wrote a poem about her, because Byron, of course he did. It's called Maid of Athens, Ere We Part.
Yeah.
Apparently not one of his best. Different times.
Different times. And doesn't matter about the poem, mate. It's still a bit dodgy. Some experimented with homosexuality, apparently. Yeah. It was a capital offence in Britain until the mid-19th century. So some used the grand tour to seek out homosexual affairs, where if discovered, it wouldn't bring immediate shame on their families. And in some places in Europe at the time, it was just much more acceptable.
Yeah, exactly. So, why not? Who can blame them, any of them, for putting it about, really? I mean, most of them were having to return home to get married off to some landowner's daughter they didn't love, who they'd never met, in deals that were made between families. You know how it works in these circles. So, they'll be having their last hurrah, really.
Difficult to know exactly what proportion of grand tourists were just on an extended shagathon, I suppose. There's not much going to be written in the accounts, is there, of that?
No, I mean, I guess the most debauched ones were not writing home to mum and dad in detail about what they were up to. They were writing home to mum and dad occasionally asking for money, I expect, but that's probably about it.
And the more virginal grand tourists, on the other hand, were the ones who did write lengthy accounts of their travels. Mm. And these accounts would often contain quite a lot of complaints about the laddie ones rutting their way across Europe.
Oh, they're just jealous, John. Yeah. Though all this did mean one thing, John, and that is that there was another sort of souvenir that the grand tourists often brought home with them.
Yes.
Good old venereal disease, which at the time were diseases that nobody back home really knew how to treat. So largely as a result of grand tours, syphilis and gonorrhea ran amok through Georgian England.
Of course. Yeah. And VD was not only a danger to your own health, but it could also harm the chances of you securing heirs to an estate.
Yeah, quite. I mean, imagine their mums when they got home. I don't care if your balls are the size of planets. Right now, your father and I are more concerned who's going to keep our good name going.
Right.
And I expect they probably left a fair number of illegitimate children in their wake
documented. Drinking excessively, gambling seemed to be another common way to spend the grand tour.
Yeah, you'll be surprised to hear this, John, again, but the British had a bit of a reputation for drunken brawling and being a bit of a pain in the arse for locals on the continent. I know, ring the bell. Yeah. Couldn't happen today, etc. There were loads of contemporary newspaper reports telling tales of drunk Brits brawling, road rage, pissing on statues, taking dumps in Italian churches.
We've all done that, Angela.
Oh, God.
Jesus, it's bad enough being embarrassed about our reputation abroad today, but having to be ashamed for 300 years of Brits showing up in Europe is even worse.
So doing a grand tour wasn't all plain sailing, literally.
Yeah.
Their journeys were really risky. They were fraught with danger.
Yeah.
You know, they weren't like interrailing now or something. Well, you know, these were proper dangerous journeys they were making. And tourists did die on their tours or get injured or, you know, things did happen to them. Crime was a big problem for tourists. They were often targets for robberies.
Yes. Obviously, this was a time of great poverty for many in Europe. So these rich foreigners flashing the cash about were prime targets.
Yeah. I mean, the tourists were mostly mixing with people of the same or at least similar social status to themselves.
Yeah.
Or maybe the new bourgeoisie, the merchants, the traders, the innkeepers, etc. But many people in these countries were starving. Remember, in the 18th century, revolution is in the air in France. What did these people, these peasants, make of these toffs coming rampaging through their country, you know?
Yeah, Bullingdon Club on tour, isn't it?
Yeah, really? Exactly. And then, of course, not only were you contending with crime, rough sea crossings, carriage accidents, difficult mountain terrains, getting lost, being extorted for money, sickness.
Shit roads and the clap.
Shit roads and the clap. But it was also quite possible during your grand tour that you might find yourself in a country that Britain was suddenly at war with.
Yeah, I mean, Britain was at war with France for a lot of this century, 1689 to 1713, 1793 to 1815. You got the 7 years war in the middle of that, which ran for, I can't remember how long
that
went.
Can't remember, some length of time.
That joke again. Welcome back, old friend.
Oh. But to be honest, a lot of the tours just carried on regardless, because warfare was different then. You know, it's not massive bombing campaigns, and they took part in a place that you could avoid, you know.
Yes.
And so many tourists either remain blissfully unaware or unconcerned. It might be the case that if you had a military posting back home, or if you were royal, you might have to cut your tour short to fight or for diplomatic reasons.
Right.
But quite often the tours just carried on.
In 1789, when the French Revolution started hotting up, there are accounts from grand tourists in Paris at the time.
Mm.
And the ruins of the Bastille immediately became just a sight to tick off on things to see.
Yeah, exactly. Incredible. Exactly. It's surprising, really, that the dangers didn't put more people off. And especially for their families, you'd think if you're sending away, if that was your only son and heir, that's quite a risk to send them away on this trip.
And it must have been incredibly expensive business. Mm. I mean, I think few kept accounts of their whole trip, and most were financed by family. But getting you and your entourage across Europe, accommodation, food, bribes, museum costs, and just the sheer cost of buying enough artifacts to fill your gallery back home must have really added up.
Yeah. But the cost and dangers didn't seem to put people off. They obviously thought it was worth it to turn their sons into the most richly educated and well-rounded young men.
Yes, albeit men absolutely riddled with VD.
Yes, you know, they were sort of, these guys, I suppose, were sort of the influencers of their day.
Yeah.
There was a word, actually, for the grand tourists when they got back home. They were known as macaronis.
Because they'd been to Italy and eaten macaroni.
Well, yeah, really.
Okay.
And so macaroni became a term for these young, wealthy men in their fancy Parisian outfits, probably dropping bits of Italian into their speech, you know, being ever so sophisticated and knowledgeable.
Yes, it's like when someone goes, oh, yeah, I can have two cappuccini, please.
Yes,
you want,
exactly.
You want to hit them when they're in Starbucks. Oi, it's over here. It's two cappuccinos, mate.
Yeah.
A macaroni had actually been to and seen all the things you read about in your history books at school.
Yeah, they were cool. And actually, did you know this, John?
No.
It's what the, you know, in the rhyme Yankee Doodle Dandy?
Yes.
That's what the macaroni refers to. So in the Wars of Independence, Yankee Doodle Dandy was an English song taking the piss out of the unsophisticated Americans. So he said he'd stick a feather in his hat and think that makes him a macaroni.
Oh, I see. Well,
stuck a feather in his hat and call him macaroni.
Okay.
Yeah,
doesn't make much sense
otherwise,
does it?
There you go.
Yeah. So grand tours definitely had a huge effect on British art and culture.
Yeah, absolutely. Neoclassicism emerged in Britain in the mid-18th century, largely because of the grand tourists.
Right.
The excavations that we talked about at Herculaneum and Pompeii, they led to this fashion for Greco-Roman art and culture that they brought home with them. And so there were architects like Robert Adam, who was a famous neoclassical architect. He was inspired by the symmetry, proportion and grandeur of these ancient structures and started to incorporate these classical elements into his designs back home and started designing country houses in this style.
Right. I think that's why the White House looks like that, because it's a very much sort of Roman Republic look, as a different look to the British monarchy sort of style.
Absolutely.
Of style of house. So the tour shaped the taste and style of the elite who, while heading to these places because of a love of ancient history, they're also exposed to contemporary art and artists on the continent, weren't they?
Yeah, there's the British painter Joshua Reynolds. He was so impressed by what he was seeing in the European art academies that he came back and helped establish the Royal Academy. He was their first president in 1768.
Ah, and of course it laid the foundations for tourism as we know it today.
Yeah, that's right. So it played a big part in British culture.
Yeah.
As we know, not everyone back home was a fan of the Grand Tour as a concept. Lots of people saw it as a pointless drain on the economy, spending all this money in other countries.
Yes. Yeah, there's a newspaper estimate in 1786 claimed that over £1 million was spent annually in Paris by British tourists.
Yeah, it was a lot of money at that time.
A hell of a lot of money.
And of course, at this time, tourism, it wasn't flowing back. There weren't vast numbers of continental visitors flocking to do their grand tour of the British Isles. I mean, let's face it, most of the stuff we had worth seeing then, we'd nicked from them in the first place.
Absolutely.
You know, and as the 18th century went on, people outside of aristocratic circles were beginning to do grand tours as they got, the middle classes got wealthier and so on. So they were like, we'll emulate the aristocracy. And so the grand tourists then begin to get a bit of a reputation back home, not unlike the gap year students, I suppose. Suddenly there they are swanning around in their silly fashions with their enormous wigs like they wore on the continent. And these macaronis, instead of being the emblems of social status that they had been, were gradually seen as being more and more affected and effeminate, something to be ridiculed.
Okay, they were characterised as gaunt men with tight trousers, striped stockings and extravagant wigs.
Yeah.
So satirical cartoons showed them wearing massive wigs topped off by tiny little hats or with hair so long that they needed a servant to carry it around for them. Satire.
See?
We don't care what we
say. There was a song at the time that described a macaroni and it went, his taper waist so straight and long, his spindle shanks like pitchfork prong. To what sex does the thing belong? 'Tis called a macaroni. So there was this real thing about them being like women and being effeminate, and that was a real insult, you know.
Okay. Yeah. So the French Revolution and the Napoleonic Wars did slow down the grand tours a bit. And then by the 1840s, the railways came along.
We know a podcast about that, don't we, John?
We do, very good.
Yeah.
Travel began to be for more than just the wealthiest of the wealthiest, and the era of the aristocratic grand tour came to an end.
There it is. A bit of an overview of the grand tours of the 17th and 18th century. Just made me want a holiday, John, isn't it?
not really. Like I said before, when I was 16, I was sent sailing with a French family across the Bay of Biscay on my own. They were like 30 and 40, and I was 16. They all were like in the nude on this boat. And then they dumped me at Cadiz to go to the airport or fly home. There was an air traffic control strike, and I had to get home from Cadiz by train with no money. And reading about the Grand Tour and people running out of money and asking for favours, that's basically me, age 16, at the border between France and Spain, borrowing money off this Canadian bloke, ending up in Paris in a place like the equivalent of Swindon with no money, nowhere to sleep, and walking to a police station asking for help. I mean, that was an adventure, though, John.
At 16.
And my mum goes, oh, it's very character building. It's like, well, thanks a lot, mum. So, yeah, maybe it was quite character building for these young men to sort of encounter these problems, and they must have all sorts of logistical
although I don't think it's probably their tutors that had to solve them and their servants rather than them.
Maybe it was character building then. But I think I'm going to stick to a weekend at the Peak District in a nice rented cottage, Angela. But thanks for the recommendation. Very interesting episode, Angela. Thank you for educating me about
that.
I didn't know anything about it.
I think we're going to wrap up there. We should do some shout outs to our Patreon supporters because they mean that we can keep doing this. We can justify the time it takes to research and to put these out for you. So thank you. We've got a couple of shout outs for this one. Shall I start, John?
Why not?
Let's say hello and thank you to Tracy Anderton,
Dylan Buckle,
Deb P,
and Cheryl Bell.
It's thanks to you that we can do this. So, and we love making this podcast, so we're delighted that you like it too. We're really chuffed.
To find out more about Patreon, who have access to exclusive episodes, live Zooms, and loads of great merchandise, visit patreon.com/wearehistory.
Yes. And I know we always say follow us on Twitter or X or whatever it is, but I don't know about you, John. I've sort of stopped doing Twitter a bit, really, but we are on Instagram. So find us on there. We Are History. Well, I am. John's a boomer, so, you know, it doesn't bother. But
we'll be back next week with another thrilling episode of We Are History. Thanks for listening. Thanks for your nice comments.
Do give us a review if you can on Apple Podcasts, because not only does it help get us up the ratings and things like that, it gives us a little warm glow when we get a nice review, doesn't it?
Depends what they say, Angela. Don't read some of them. Yeah. No, I jest. Thank you very much, everyone. See you next week.
Bye.
We Are History is written and presented by Angela Barnes and John O'Farrell, with audio production by me, Simon Williams. The lead producer is Anne-Marie Luff, and the group editor is Andrew Harrison, with artwork by James Parrott. We Are History is a Podmasters production.